We're in the book of Romans. We're approaching the half century mark of 50. And we're still in the 17th verse of the first chapter. Dikaiosune, in the red letters here. Righteousness. You should have that same piece of paper if you haven't run out. You have it? And the translation given normally in Greek New Testament's the righteousness. You see it added down there in the translation. Scratch it out. Paul knew how to write a definite article, and it's not there. God's not limited in his expressions of righteousness. As I said previously, with all the discussion of the meaning of the word, all the various interpretations of righteousness and the tracing of this word from the root dikai down through the language, righteousness is self-existent status of being God. God's righteousness. That means whatever he does defines righteousness. He is righteous, being what we would view by some other standard, unrighteous. He is. Period. Now let's play God for a moment. We do whatever we want. And I trample on some sacred, preserved, traditional view of what righteousness is. And we've mutually agreed, because it's ingrained within us, that God must be righteous. But we know what righteousness is. And all of a sudden, I'm playing God. And I do something that's unrighteous in your view. You can't do that, God. Splat. And you is no more, and I still is. You are dead. And whatever further consequences I want to give you, and I am that I am. Now, that being the definition, as I've said, God stays God because he's all-powerful. Thanks be to God. He has revealed himself, opened a window, let us see his consistent nature, the way he is. And most of us are so blind we don't want to see him the way he is. That's why God lamented of the people he chose. And he said to them, you know, God, I wish God were not such an illustration of what he is. I wish on some occasions he'd be a little more like I want to be. I mean, I wouldn't have put up with the Israelites as long as he did. Absolutely wouldn't have. But he put up with them, and he lets us see. And then finally, he says, I can almost hear him saying, oh, foot. $3.25 million. I get real frustrated at the low percentage of people that seem to really understand what I'm teaching, and I'm just the conveyor belt. He's the one that said it. $3.25 million. And years of demonstrating the way he is. One product. All the rest of the people, all they see is my actions. Dodging and ducking. And then lapping it in when it's good. Only one. Moses came to know my ways. Now, we have a saying, you get to know people well, that's the way she is. That's the way he is. Only Moses got to know the way God is. We can thank God. He has revealed his ways, his goodness, his mercy, his grace, and most of all, his faithfulness to his word. But you have to be. And once in a while, you push him too far because he's a living person, not some list of things with boxes all over his body to check when you have conformed. Once in a while, he just says, foot. Two times. I'm imitating God at his best. Eli. And he anticipates Eli saying, you can't do this to me because I was in the loins of, that's interesting, Aaron. When you promised to him and his seed a perpetual priesthood, and God knew what he's going to say, going to use his rules against him. You can't do this to me after he had flaunted his disobedience in letting those reprobate kids of his defile the tabernacle. And God anticipated what he's going to say. Don't. And he said, don't even try. In the famous words, don't even think about it. Make my day. Don't even think about reminding me of what I said about you when you were in the loins of Aaron. I know what I said. I don't need you to remind me. But now I'm saying this. You and your line are wiped out and you're dead, and off that log he went with a broken neck and his line was wiped out. But God said God found a way to keep Aaron's line going, but not through Eli. Don't tell me what I said. You pushed me too far. Now I'm saying. So then you have to understand the ways of God are such that he is faithful to his word, but 21st century brats who exploit that, he can get enough. He can get enough. And then all of a sudden, you don't even have standing to argue with him. And he suddenly is not faithful to the abuser of his word and reverses himself. He's equally righteous because he knows the heart, and he gave more chances and will give more chances than anyone else. He can do what he wants. Thus, righteousness by that definition, which is what we're talking about, is wherever God is doing whatever God does or wants to do. And a kind of his righteousness, the kind that we ought to be most interested in, that which can reach to us and become our possession, that righteousness of God in it, in alto, in the gospel itself, is revealed, apokalupteti. Now I want you to remember that word. Circle it on your piece of paper. Apokalupteti. If you trace it back to its roots, oh, it's the same word from which we get, quote, book of Revelation, because it's a revelation, an apocalypse, to take the cognate word into the English. It is unveiling. Now, apocalypse today is a terrible nuclear blast, first cousin to the Holocaust. But its root meaning is to uncover, like coming out of the grave. Now remember that. And the book of Revelation uncovers and brings out of a temporary burial in the faithfulness of God the bursting forth. And it begins with the resurrected one opening the seals, And it comes to a close, as far as history is concerned, with the resurrected one bringing we other resurrected ones back with him to rescue this earth buried under the darkness of the rule of the prince of darkness. Just remember, everything in this book of Romans, as everything about Christianity, presupposes is nonsense without the resurrection as a historic fact and event. He's coming to Rome to talk about the power, dunamis, of the gospel. And he's going to talk about the resurrection power, which produces the righteousness of God uncovered out of the grave. I say all of that because this apparent pause on the resurrection is a necessary part of unfolding what the book of Romans is teaching about the power of God in the gospel and the power of God to produce righteousness, which is his own living righteousness expressing itself through us. And here's Christ in the grave according to Reggie. I thought he did very well, is to get across the idea that Jesus wasn't wrapped like a mummy, but rather a shroud over his whole body and under it, covered him in that manner as he was laid in the tomb with the feet and hands loosely bound and a headband or a jaw band to keep his jaw from falling open and rigor mortis, which was the Jewish system of burial. We've seen so many pictures of Egyptian mummies, and the King James translations take simple words that in the Greek mean wrapped, once as well as many, and turn it into a translation of wound. Well, this is wound, but normally when you read the King James, you think wound up like that. He was simply wrapped with a cloth, laying on his front and under him on his back. I said last Sunday, I do not want what I introduced about the Shroud of Turin to become a foundational basis of what I'm going to present as the rational defense of the resurrection based upon evidence and facts. The shroud does not become a major part of my annual presentation and was not a part of my restoration to faith through a study of the resurrection. I only introduced the shroud because if there was a resurrection, then that resurrection and the entrance of life into this dead body and the generated energy that melted the cellulose fibers on the inside only of the shroud, not on the other side, which is no longer even credible to discuss about it being painted on. There's no painting, no ink, no pigments. The only thing produced natural are the blood stains, which would happen if you put a shroud around anybody. And science has confirmed there are blood stains. It's the image, the photo-like image in reverse, the negative that astounds people and how it could be produced. I don't know if you can get close enough, but I'm going to try you to see if Kent can pick up This image, that's the front image on the right side of your screen. Come in as close as you can to the head. I'll give you another head. Go back and get the whole full length. That's the image on the shroud of the front. Now go to the other page, which is the back side. Which shows the wounds in a manner consistent with the instrument of beating in that century, a wooden handle or a solid handle of some kind. The straps or ropes with pieces of bone or metal in them that would cut chunks out as this heavy instrument. And this person buried there, whose image is there, was beaten by two people on two sides, showing the lashes going different ways. The amazing thing about the shroud is the three-dimensional burning of the fibers. If heat produces the image, it will be a distance. What do I do with that book? If heat produces the image, it will, like holding a match before a little cord, it will, the closer the heat-producing radiation spot is, will burn a deeper image. Thus you will end up, as was discovered recently by scientists, with the capacity to reproduce a three-dimensional image, like they do with the computerized images of the surface of Mars, taken distant ways. That's done a different way. In this case, the three-dimensionality is because whatever heat scorched this image, those parts of the body and face that were closer to the fabric would scorch a little deeper, leaving a three-dimensional image capable of being reproduced and shown in like manner. If I can pick this up, bottom picture here, Kent, if you can pick it up. Can you see that three-dimensional face? In reverse, negative. Something I didn't know about centuries ago. Now, all I'm saying about the shroud before I get into today's message is that if the resurrection occurred, it becomes a valid hypothesis to explain the image, because science is now concluding, the majority opinion overwhelming, books continue to pile up, a declaration by the cardinal in charge approved by the Pope, and current opinions are now recognizing that the scorch theory, somewhere or other, is the best explanation. British philosopher Geoffrey Ashe suggested that Jesus underwent an unparalleled transformation in the tomb. Ashe wrote, "It is at least intelligible that the physical change of the body at the resurrection may have released a brief and violent burst of radiation, perhaps scientifically identifiable, perhaps not, which scorched the cloth. In this case, the shroud image is a quasi-photograph of Christ returning to life, produced by a kind of radiance or incandescence analogous to heat in its effects." Physicists began to suspect that the image itself points toward a scorch caused by light instead of heat, that would have added carbon-14 isotopes to the shroud, thereby giving it the appearance of being younger than it was. Physicist Thomas Phillips disputes any claim of carbon-14 dating that suggests the shroud has an earlier date than the first century. If Christ was truly resurrected, contends Phillips, then the neutron flux phenomenon would have distorted the carbon-14 test, making the shroud seem less antique than it really is because of additional carbon deposits on the linen. Phillips, who conducted super collider research at the Enrico Fermi Laboratory in suburban Chicago, conceded that, quote, we've never had a resurrection to measure before. The Holy Shroud continues to fascinate the scientific community by pointing to realities beyond our normal experience. A moment of time that altered the future of humanity, perhaps leaving an imprint. And if the man wrapped in the shroud, and it's pretty clear it was a man, and if he suffered the same marks of resurrection as Christ, and it's pretty clear he did, and this would be an interesting attempt to duplicate the sufferings of Christ, and it certainly was a success. And here, imprinted in this shroud, are the marks of that man and his death that forever altered artistic representations of Christ because of the belief that began first with a linen cloth out of Edessa, folded 8 times until only the head showed. That man, if he raised from the dead, and light, which in every case is associated with God's presence and the power of the Spirit after Resurrection Day, including the light that knocked Paul from off his horse or was seen when he was knocked off his horse and the voice spoke, then such an instant surge, more of the nature of light than just raw heat, creating this image, the resurrection could explain the shroud, and the shroud would indeed become a relic marking the event. And I've often mused about this fact. If there is a resurrection, and we all make it to heaven. Now, I've talked about some Christians making it to heaven, and have, with my weird sense of humor, said I would like to have the guide dog, the dogs that lead the blind. I would like to have the franchise on that in heaven, because traditional Christians only talk to God with their eyes closed. So, at the risk of seeing God when they get there, they've got to enter heaven. And I want to be at the gate with the guide dog franchise. And as they come in, where are you, Jesus? I want to hand the dog to them. I haven't yet figured out how to train the dog to recognize Jesus. And the hosts of heavenly angels are there. And we sing the songs. How blessed we'll be to see my Jesus there. Can you see us hunkered at the gate, looking around and saying, which one is him? Will the real Jesus please stand up? You think I'm mocking, maybe? No. I'm saying, why wouldn't God leave an imprint that makes us recognize Him? The closest that I ever came to what I would call a vision, I always envied my dad in his vision, is in the event my parents tell me how sick I was. I don't remember that. My parents say I was just a child. 7 convulsions, one after another, is the way my mother described it. I only remember two things. I remember a hazy memory of sitting up in bed and saying, Daddy, I want a drink. And sort of fuzzily, it seems I was very quickly outside playing. I'm told by my parents, 7 convulsions, they were sure I was going to die. The pastor was there praying at the foot of the bed. But what I remember as clearly as looking at you. I don't know how the ceiling went away. There just wasn't any ceiling. I just remember like looking up at this cathedral ceiling here. I saw like a midnight blue sky that you'd see on a dark, clear night. And like a Dutch door opened. And brilliant light behind the door, but framed in that half door from about here up was what I instantly recognized in my child mind as Jesus. Now I can explain that God's going to reveal himself in symbols or signs that are recognizable to us. He knows what's in our mind if he is. And therefore, I studied in Sunday school and they have pictures of Jesus that look a certain way. So that's imprinted in my brain. Therefore, Jesus would take the form to look like I would expect him to look so I could recognize him. That's a legitimate explanation. But where do those images come from that dominate religious art? And I covered that last Sunday with you. And why wouldn't the one who took our form, moved into the tent of human flesh, raised with that mortal body made immortal? Why would it be inconceivable that he might leave an image? And it wasn't until that man, De Leon, whose earlier name was a word in the Greek that means to fold a certain way, not just linen cloth, but a linen cloth that's folded a certain way that leaves just the head showing. And I add the fact, if you know he's raised, and you have an image of a loved one. Let's assume you have one of these cameras that the coroner's office and your loved one had an accident that has squares that show parts of the body who died in shame, unable to be washed because of the time they took him down. And you have a picture of the whole body. The death was not so paramount to these first century Christians. The living Savior was what was paramount. And my guess is if you were remembering a loved one, you would fold the picture under and frame the head to have that memory. All of this is intriguing, interesting. New books come out every day. There's sites on the internet. There are those that are determined before they look to put it down because they argue as they argue about the resurrection. It couldn't happen, therefore it didn't happen, therefore we must disprove it. Well, it has survived the attacks of fraud since the 13th century. I'm not a crusader for the shroud. I'm a crusader for the resurrection, and I'm going to give you the evidence for that. But if the resurrection's true, it's the best explanation to be found of the radiation of life itself in a spurt where God raised him from the dead. Out from this shroud, take off the jawband, an angel in an earthquake rolled the stone away. And that stone, if you understand how to read the Greek, was rolled uphill to get it out of the way. And in that radiation life, taking the jaw cloth off and laying it separately, and the grave clothes laying there, this shroud cloth. Now, I have all kinds of funny things that go on in my head. Because shortly thereafter, he's seen by Mary. What was he wearing? He said, "Don't touch me, I haven't yet ascended the Father." Now, here's the man who spoke and created the world, so I'm sure he could say, "Levi James. B." But remember, these women were there at the cross. And contrary to religious art, and true to the shroud, contrary to religious art, he was naked. They put some wrapping around his private parts. And these women watched him. The women stayed, the men left. Oh, some of you are so holy. You do not believe that Jesus had kidneys. I don't want to talk about the other parts. Get real. It's as blasphemous to deny his humanity as to deny his divinity. Get real. So don't take your Victorian attitudes. These women were going to go wash and cleanse his dead body, his naked body under this shroud to prepare him for his final resting place, because they thought he was dead. So don't make a big deal out of him. He may have, maybe the angel that rolled the stone away brought a glistening white robe for him to wear. But my brain says, you know, this really happened. Quit spiritualizing it. Here is this man, God-man, now divine man-God, standing there. He said, "Don't touch me. I haven't yet ascended to the Father," because it was a part of the type of the role of the priest on the Day of Atonement, who not only had to offer the sacrifice, but had to take it to the place called the propitiatory, and there let the testimony come that the sacrifice was adequate, and then he comes out and the people know the sins are forgiven. So the whole deed to fulfill what God had said is the way in which redemption comes was not finished on the cross until he ascended to the presence of the Father, typified in the Holy of Holies, and the propitiatory, the place where the sacrifice was declared enough. Then he comes back, clothed, I'm sure. But he's still the sacrifice. In other words, the priest carried the blood of the sacrifice containing the life into the Holy of Holies. And he had bells on the bottom of his garments that let the people outside know. They saw the sacrifice. They could look through the gate and see it. It was in the outer court. But when he carried that blood of the sacrifice on the Day of Atonement containing the life, he disappeared behind the curtains into the Holy of Holies, typifying our high priest who offered his own blood and now must take himself to the presence where the propitiatory, that's the place, recognizes adequate propitiation, enough has been offered to satisfy all claims and forgiveness. In that case, for a year, when the priest came out, the bell stopped ringing. They know he was dead because the sacrifice was not adequate. They didn't hear any more bells. This resurrected life, penetrating that body, raising him from the dead, gives an answer to the question, what made the image? I find that fascinating. But not the basis for my faith. I leave that with you to pursue. The faith in the resurrection is based upon disciplined laying of the frame of reference for discussion first. Jesus lived. You don't believe that? That's much easier to prove. than that he rose. Crucified, hands of the Romans, instigated by Jewish charges, and he was crucified not for what he did, but for who he claimed to be. Don't ever forget that. In most criminal trials, you condemn the person to execution because of what he did. Only in genocide and racism and other kinds of execution because of who you are can we compare to Jesus' trial. He was condemned because of claims he made about himself. And ultimately before the high priest wearing these priestly garments dating back to God's orders on Mount Sinai through Moses to Aaron. Those were never to be rent except in certain conditions. And the high priest asked him, as he claimed to be Son of God, he says, I am. And the high priest tears his garments. We need no witnesses. He's self-condemned. This is blasphemy. Take him away. He was charged. And as I have said, I respect the Jewish leaders for recognizing that no man can make the claims that Jesus made about himself. And that was a previous message and previous messages for 25 years and 7 volumes or 6-volume book series that is available, plus tapes for 25 years. He went about making claims about himself that other founders of religion never made about themselves. And to make such claims was recognized by the Jewish leaders as blasphemous. He's either a nut who believed the impossible about himself, or a fraudulent deceiver able to convince others of the impossible claims, but knowing better, and thus a fraud. And the Jewish leaders condemned him for blasphemy. He was crucified. After 6 trials, considered dead, buried in a known, accessible, guarded, sealed tomb. All the records are the same. Joseph of Arimathea, with Nicodemus' help, put him in the tomb. It was a known tomb of a prominent citizen of the city, member of the Sanhedrin, his own newly prepared tomb. And he rolled a stone against it. Able to do, though it was massive, because it was prepared this way. He rolled it downhill. And in some of the records, the women, when they're coming, are worrying. And they testify to their worry. How are we going to move this big stone we heard is there? They didn't see it, but the record is complete. How are we going to move the stone? And the Greek is very precise. When the angel rolled it away, or they come and recognize it's away, the words have it uphill. This massive stone was rolled uphill. Angel did it according to the gospel writers. And because it had been said that he would raise, the Jewish leaders got the Romans to put a guard there and seal it. Penalty of death. You break a Roman seal. He was preached, raised, the tomb empty, ascended. The Jewish leaders, more concerned to disprove it than we'd be, for obvious reasons, their bread and butter and prestige and position was at stake. So the disciples were persecuted terribly for preaching this message, and from the beginning it was stopped saying he rose from the dead. And the answer was, you crucified him, you hanged him on a tree, you desired a murderer in his place, but God raised him up from the dead. Therefore, there was an empty tomb, because even a quasi-moron can figure out if they could have gone to the tomb, found a body, they'd have shut all the preaching up, didn't have to persecute anybody. Those facts must be taken for granted for an intelligent discussion of the resurrection Otherwise, go back and settle these facts. Because every one of them is much easier to demonstrate than the resurrection. But for intelligent discussion of the resurrection, I assume these facts. And I ask you to assume them while I, based on those facts, show you what happens to the theories. Now, when I finished this with my major prof at Stanford University, Larry Thomas, who was led my doctoral committee, he was skeptical, too. I remember I challenged him many times. I said, Larry, I was by then working as his assistant, and I said, Larry, I admire you, and I can say this today, he's no longer here, but I said it while he was still alive. And I remember when Alan Perichini of the Times and later for the cover story in the Stanford Alumni magazine that he did on me, he went to Larry Thomas to check out Gene's God, as well as some go to the Stanford Library to check my doctorate on the dissertation on Reinhold Niebuhr. And Larry, I said before he died many times from this pulpit, even in his agnostic days as the leading spokesman for John Dewey, he later changed. But when Ike went there, he was the leading spokesman for John Dewey's experimentalism and progressive education. He would say to me, Gene, I don't care what you believe, because he was an agnostic. But when you get out of here, a candidate unto me, you don't know what you believe and why you believe it. And I've said publicly I respected him more than most ministers ever met for his integrity. But I gained the ability to say to him one day, Larry, you built your life in experimentalism as a philosophy, never drawing a conclusion without looking at the facts. Yet you live a life based upon an assumption that denies the resurrection of Christ. And my experience with you demonstrates you haven't spent 5 hours in your life even looking at the evidence. He said, well, Gene, can you give me a good, maybe 2-hour source? We went at it. And in later years, he changed to a faith and departed experimentalism. I hope some of my nudging. But I remember finally coming to a point where I presented to him in capsule form what I'm talking about today. And he said, yeah, I understand, okay, because he's the one that taught me the principle of philosophizing in a disciplined way. He taught philosophy as a function rather than the product of the functions of other philosophers' brains. And he was the only professor who taught it as a function. And he would discipline us 3 hours at least every week to exercise what he called the function of philosophizing in disciplined compartments using the tools of philosophy. And he said, if you learn to philosophize properly, you can read what this guy has said a few chapters, and you know what else he should have said, and if he didn't, he isn't worth reading. The disciplined brain of this man, who taught me frame of reference, which is that which you take for granted in a discussion and debate it no longer, and on the basis of accepting that which is established, you move on to the next fact, as I often illustrate. Don't argue about this message unless you take for granted I was here and preached one. All disciplined thought must organize the presuppositions called the frame of reference. And so he said, I understand that. So I can take for granted these 8 facts. I can see it on face value. Those are easier to demonstrate than the resurrection. Then I made the whole trip with him to the conclusion about the resurrection. And Larry says, Gene, you've convinced me. I'm convinced of the conclusion you draw, which I'm going to draw in a few minutes here. Therefore, since I'm convinced, there must be something wrong with your other 8 facts. Because he didn't want to accept the resurrection. People argue, I've already drawn this 1,000 times, it can't happen, therefore it didn't happen, therefore it won't happen. Therefore anybody says it did, lying, because it can't happen, didn't happen, won't happen. Anybody says it did, lying, can't happen, didn't happen, therefore you're in a circle. Christianity says can't happen anything we know. Like this route argument. They've reduced it down to a scorch theory. But they now have to admit there are energy sources we haven't yet found. There are yet to be defined energy sources. Atom is a Greek word for the undivided, indivisible. Greek philosophers who didn't have our modern scientific instruments figured and assumed somewhere reality reduces down to something you can't divide. And they named it an atom. But now we divide atoms. We don't know in English what atom means because it comes over as a cognate, but if you go to its literal meaning, we're saying we're dividing the undividable. We divide the atoms. And we get energy when they're pulled apart. There are areas of matter we now recognize that because we've defined so much by light, though that's been shattered with some of Einstein's theories, we now have a word, and it has somber tones to it. Dark matter. We can't find it because we can't see it. So it thus must be the opposite of light, which produces our capacity to see. Therefore, it's called dark matter. But it doesn't mean necessarily it's bad. Maybe what we see is dark matter. If we're going to make an ethical meaning of it, an identity with it. In other words, energy, we don't know all the sources of energy. But I'm saying these facts take us out of those speculative areas, and these are simple historic facts or deductions from those facts that are easier to demonstrate than that a resurrection occurred. That a resurrection was preached about has produced multiple theories. Disciples stole the body. Instead of killing the guard for the seal being broken, the earliest story had to enlist the guards, and in order to get them to tell a false story, you don't kill the witness, you want to tell the lie. But you can probably get the witness to tell the lie if he's done something for which he's going to be killed anyway, which is how the government works today. I mean, they can only get things done by finding the most onerous, ungodly, evil monster. And then they do what God, only God can do. They redeem him. They wash him from his sins, and they have constant testimony meetings as they put halos on him and present him as the source of all truth to get the rest of the rats. Well, here's the guards and the tomb sealed, and a massive stone is going to be rolled uphill. Earthquake comes, angel comes, rolls stone away, then they ran like hell. You wait? So would you. Now we got a problem. Tomb's empty, seal's broken, stone's rolled away. You, guards, are going to be executed. Oh, you pay this story, we'll even sweeten it with a little money. You say the disciples came and stole the body and you were sleeping. That's a minor offense. You slept compared to the seal being broken and the body stolen. You tell the story, the disciples stole the body. Another theory is the Romans came, took the body. Third theory, Jewish leaders took the body. Fourth theory, they went to the wrong tomb. Early evening or morning light, They thought they went to his tomb, went to an empty one, started telling the story. It was the wrong tomb. Fifth, resuscitation. He revived on the cross. Now, more recent theories have had him practice with Lazarus and plan this whole thing so he could come out and fake it. You don't resuscitate from a Roman crucifixion. Hallucinations. They honestly believed they saw these things, but they were having hallucinations. They made the whole thing up. They just lied. They'd put their faith in a man who claimed all these things about himself, that if they were true, it was not blasphemy, he was God. But now he dies this shameful death on a tree that's the equivalent of a curse being put on him. And we've lost face. The same thing, these people would lose face if the resurrection occurred. We've lost face if we don't manufacture one. It's even argued they waited 7 weeks to announce it, which is a lie, twisted facts again. And on the day of Pentecost, they're ready to make their big announcement. It took them 7 weeks to concoct the story. They're liars. They bet on the wrong horse. They're making up a lie to save face. They know they're liars because they're concocting a fraud. Or they told the truth. Now, of course, Jesus' seminar people say his body was thrown out where the dogs go in a trash pile. And that the resurrection theory, since all this only happens a couple centuries later, those people are a bigger fraud than the earlier ones because they claim to be academics and they do not do true research. They come with a priori notions of what they will accept and reject. And they say the resurrection, one of their spokespeople says, the resurrection is an attempt. It's a power play. They got to somehow construct the church. And you can one-up everyone else if you saw Jesus resurrected. So you tell this story as a way of putting your power shoulders a little higher. So, I only need one fact over here to save time. You read the books, there's six of them. They got fancy little covers. Jesus Christ, Super Nut or Supernatural. Six volumes that tell the story of the resurrection. But I only need one. They preached not just a resurrection, an empty tomb that was known, accessible, and locatable, and an ascension. All of that was part of their message. Disciples stole the body, obviously, then they're liars. You follow that, don't you? The Romans took the body as totally untenable because they could have stopped all the unrest by simply saying, we took the body. But it does not explain the empty tomb or the ascension. So they're still lying with the balance of their message. Jewish leaders took the body. That's really a no-brainer. Who could have gained the most by saying, in fact, the Jewish leaders of that century could wish they had thought of this. We took his body. And oops, we threw it out in the trash pile and the dogs ate it. But we took the body to keep you from telling this story. They could wish they had thought of that. But it still wouldn't explain the preaching of the ascension and the resurrection appearances. This whole story can't fit into wrong tomb, go to the right one. Untenable. Doesn't explain ascension, resuscitation. They didn't preach a sick, half-dead, dried blood, staggering resuscitator. They're still making up most of the story. You can't get around the fact they're lying. I would like to take the time to read just a little bit about hallucinations. In one of the books, as I preach every year, more and more books come out. That's wonderful. that have to do with this resurrection message. It used to, Ken and Brian Green and then myself were the only ones, other than the dead ones like C.S. Lewis and the attorney who wrote Who Moved the Stone. Now books abound on the subject. By far the most prevalent occupied tomb theory for explaining away the resurrection of Christ is that people only thought they had seen him. I'm reading one of Josh McDowell's books, The Resurrection Factor. The word hallucination is an anglicized form of the Latin term hallucination, which means a wandering of the mind, idle talk, prating. Didn't become a technical term in psychology and medicine until the 19th century. Hallucination is perhaps one of the unique words in medicine that remained the same, unaltered, from late 19th century to the present. American Psychiatric Association's official glossary defines a hallucination as a false sensory perception in the absence of an actual external stimulus. An apparent perception of an external object when no such object is present. It requires, normally, it happens to schizophrenics, mentally unstable people who have a history of that. It also requires certain conditions linked to an individual subconscious and his particular past experience, making it very unlikely that two different people would have the same hallucination. A very private event. Usually restricted as to when and where they can happen. Favorable circumstances are missing. An expectancy is usually a preclude, a dwelling on a subject that has an element of something you expect usually brings it. And hallucinations usually occur over a long period of time with noticeable regularity. Whereas in this case, it all stopped. It all stopped. These appearances all stopped, with Paul being the last one. Different people, same things. But all that complicated studying of the psychiatric principles behind hallucination, which is attractive because it lets you use words and talk about things that most people don't understand because the one who's talking about it doesn't understand it either. It's just what too much of psychology is. B.S. Apart from common sense that produces the reaction, ah, well, while you're hallucinating, I'm going to the tomb. And the body is going to bust your dream. And it does not explain the rest of the story. Hallucinations do not explain an empty tomb. And hallucinations do not happen to above 500 people at once for the same thing, and doesn't happen to a group of people watching somebody go away in the sky. They lie. Power play? What? You're making up a story to give yourself power. Still a lie. There's only two options. People don't want to be put in that kind of corner. Disciplined thought produces conclusion. If you're sitting on a jury, you can never be sure. All historic truth is relative the moment you can no longer be an eyewitness. But you have psychological certainty, even though historic certainty by definition requires every logical possible piece of evidence there. And eyewitnessing is a logically possible piece of evidence. And when that's gone, then all historic certainty has to be relative. Psychological certainty occurs as a happening when you expose yourself to the evidence. It forces you away from objectivity to a subjective conclusion. My undergraduate major was history. I came to hate so-called objective historians, because they're lying. You cannot truly be acquainted with a subject without coming to an opinion. I prefer a subjective historian who's honest enough to tell me his subjective opinion and then present the facts on which it was based and give me a chance to make mine. The facts may be objective, the opinion isn't. And it forces you to either-or positions. I've already said there's only one choice regarding Christ. You're at an either-or choice position. Either he's a nut making impossible claims, or a fraud who knows better, or he's what he claimed to be, which only God can make such a claim. From there, the issue, you could make his claims, I would think you were a nut or a fraud. You go in the grave as part of your claims and come out again, let's take another look at you. So the resurrection becomes the proof factor, the evidence of his right to claim who he was. Well then, I got to sell the resurrection. Other facts found it, or are the foundation for it, and the theories confronting the facts up to the point of the resurrection all reduced down to that same alternate again, either or. No matter how you slice the theories, which are little surface attempts to explain the preaching, when you don't want to accept the possibility of the facts, drive you in a corner. Credibility of the witnesses. There's only two theories that explain it. They either lied in part or whole, or they told the truth. They're just simple men and women reporting what they actually experienced as honestly as they know how to do it. And any objective study of the resurrection doesn't have to get into shrouds and other things to debate about. The shroud is explained by the resurrection. But the resurrection itself drives you down to what all trials drive you down on any historic event, the credibility of the witnesses. That's where it all boils down. Either this story was concocted by men and women who were lying and knew they were lying, or they're, to their own surprise, encountering things and telling the truth as they saw it. And you don't have any in between. Well, why is it so hard for people to accept the fact if Jesus didn't come out of the grave, he's a nut or a fraud? They don't want to look at the facts. They want to create an artificial Jesus who went around blowing bubbles. Bubbles of goodness and sweetness. Oh, they cringe from the possibility. You mean I have to make this decision? Deciding whether these disciples were lying or telling the truth. I'll even compromise my academic credentials, my integrity, to avoid it by saying all this happened 2 or 3 centuries later. Sorry. Archaeology is a science. Paleography is a science. Ability to date manuscripts and continued finding of manuscripts doesn't give them the option anymore. Dead Sea Scroll, Cave 7, the Magdalene fragments. Take Matthew and Mark to between 60 and 70 A.D. The thousands of papyri. We got one in the Corinthian letter downstairs. Takes us back to the 4th century. We have a manuscript hanging on the wall in the room of the book inside the papyri thing. Oldest in private hands. 7th century palimpsest. Palimpsest by Paul. Written over on vellum. 3 centuries later by an Ethiopic scribe. But now modern science lets us find what's underneath. We had to fight the British Museum to get it out of London and let them take pictures of it and give us credit in their museum before we were able to bring it here and put it on display. These these men, we have the letters of Ignatius, Polycarp, who was ordained by John. We have a line of first and second century witnesses, all of whom faced martyr's death. These people were either lying or telling the truth as they saw it. And there are four principal reasons why I came to the conclusion, once I was driven in my research to that corner, these men and women were telling the truth. One, what we call internal evidences. When people are historians, you look for the not obvious, inadvertent indices that show dishonesty or honesty. When somebody, you know, you're told to tell the truth because then you don't have to remember. But when you're concocting a tale, you all have to remember it. All of its details with consistency. Now, imagine for a moment, we have met, and we're going to concoct this story. And Matthew's up in Antioch, and he's going to write to the Jews that we need to convince. Mark is traveling now, having failed with Paul. He's with Peter. And he's going to get most of his facts from Peter, and he's going to write either to the Romans or the Egyptians and tell his story. And Luke, who travels with Paul, says he had several manuscripts and he's going to put together a true story as a historian. And both Mark and Luke have in common something that all the scholars, the Jesus Seminar people, try to act like it's an existing document. It isn't. But if you can read the original, go through the manuscripts, you can find that there's a change of style when Matthew and Luke are quoting Mark. And then you will find a common change of style when Matthew, Mark, and Luke are all three quoting some unknown other source. It's called the hypothetical Q document. One of the earliest fathers writes down that Matthew wrote the sayings of Jesus down when he traveled with him, not in Greek. So some have speculated that there was being circulated some writings by Matthew in Hebrew of the sayings of Christ. But there is a common source. You go to early hymns. You know that the earliest fathers, when you take the seven letters of Ignatius and Polycarp's letters, they're quoting from a source in the very first century of early documents that tell us, they're very minor, but they have a source that says things a little bit differently. And all these manuscripts mount up with the common denominators creating a solid core and fringe debatable areas. In all these sources, these people are concocting a story, let's say. Now, we got to get it down straight, because it's all made up to save face. Well, Mark is writing to Gentiles, that we know. And his purpose is to prove that Jesus is the Son of God. Now, if he were writing to Jews, they've grown up on the book of Enoch and Daniel, where the phrase Son of Man is a messianic term. The Messiah would come as Son of Man on clouds of glory to set up his kingdom. So you use Son of Man to a Jew is like politicians using mother and democracy in a political campaign. It conjures up emotional and cognitive meanings already in the memory bank. Son of Man is Messiah. Son of Man is Son of God. But if you're writing to a rank stranger, am I boring you? If you're writing to a rank stranger, out there in Greece or Egypt, with a panoply of gods, if you're going to try to prove that Jesus is Son of God and you're writing to these Romans or these Egyptians and you know you're a liar, you just want to save face for the moment, why would you not have Jesus refer to himself as Son of God? They're off in Rome. They're hearing about this fellow down here that was crucified and we're going to claim rose from the dead in Palestine. I'm a liar. I want to sell my product. Jesus is Son of God. Well, then why have him refer to himself as Son of Man? Yet Mark, who is writing to Gentiles, seeking to prove that Jesus is Son of God, go home and count them. Had Jesus referred to himself as Son of Man more times in the shortest gospel than any of the other gospels. And if you take out the other gospels that are quoting Mark, they're even less. So the guy writing to Gentiles trying to prove Jesus is Son of God and telling a lie and knows it's a lie, you're going to have him constantly refer to himself as Son of Man? I can lie better than that. So can you. Have him call himself the Son of God. Attention to detail. You remember the story where Jesus fed the multitude, fed the 5,000, fed the multitude in the wilderness? Remember the story? He says, Philip, where do we buy bread? Well, now the whole scene is out here in the desert, and you can, and I've preached on this once, you can see him taking count of what's the matter with him. He's going nuts right here in the desert. There ain't no grocery stores around here, no 7-Eleven, no Arco AMPM. What's he talking about? And furthermore, we only got a few pennies. We couldn't buy enough for ourselves, much less this multitude. And he's saying to Philip, where do we buy bread? Why Philip? You go to another gospel, and to another place in the same gospel, different context, you find Philip was born at Bethsaida. You find that the place where the multitude is, the closest town is Bethsaida. So, here you have to go to three different sources in these ancient documents to find, ah, so. He should have asked Philip, because Philip's the only one who knew where the AM market was in Bethsaida. You don't give that attention to detail. You can gloss it over. Women are the first witnesses. Just think about that for a minute, all you feminists. I'd be glad you're born today. Under Jewish law, women could not even be a witness presenting evidence. Women were considered so inferior and unreliable and unable to give adequate testimony, they weren't even allowed to testify. Now, if I'm making this up, I'm going to have the first announcers, women. Oh, man, if I'm trying to win the presidential election today with feminists on their high horse going strong, I would probably use this in my campaign. Ladies, God dignified womanhood by letting them be the first witness. But not that century. You could not make your story seem at first glance less credible than to have women the first witnesses. Therefore, what's the issue? They're lying or telling the truth? If they're smart enough to make this story up and sell it as well as they did, they're smart enough to not make these surface mistakes, which are not mistakes. They suggest Mark, if it hurt his cause, is going to have Jesus say what Jesus said, because when Jesus was saying it, he was saying it to a Jewish audience. And though Mark is writing to an audience where Son of Man is a phrase hurts his case, he's going to quote him exactly. That sounds like an honest man. Women are reported as the first witnesses because they were the first witnesses. Intangible little ideas flicked in that sounds like honest people talking, not people making up a story. Little statements like, who's going to move the stone away? All these little details woven into the story suggest credibility. And the so-called 7-week gap. Well, we're smart enough to tell this story. One of us is going to say, we better cover the fact that somebody's going to ask, why'd we wait 7 weeks? It doesn't become a support for fraud that the burst of preaching occurred in the seventh week or 50 days after. It doesn't support the idea they were frauds. They were testifying among one another to the disbelief of Thomas, for example. But rather it supports the credibility, because they're so amazed at the resurrection, these fleeing and disobedient ones prior to the resurrection are suddenly captured with the new reality. And he says, you will be witnesses unto me, starting at Jerusalem to the whole earth. But first, tarry at Jerusalem until ye be endued with power from on high. And these credible people who are going to only tell what they saw as they honestly saw it, whether it hurts their story or helps it, they go to that upper room and they stay there until the power fell. And then instantly on the street below, they're preaching the resurrection. You desired a murderer to be granted unto you, but God raised him from the dead. I could go on. It's in the series of books. Indirect. Number two is the cataclysmic change that occurs to the tellers of this story. I can believe a lie changes somebody, seldom for the better. Every one of these characters are cataclysmically changed. Cataclysmically changed, not just with the resurrection event itself. That produced an obedient act that took them to the fruit of the resurrection event, and the claim that because he's alive, he can send the same power to change us on the day of Pentecost, and they're instantly changed. John's reputation is woven, and if I didn't worship God and his son Jesus Christ, I could worship those who created this fraud if it's really a lie. The way they hid the personality traits, John and his brother are called sons of thunder. What the media would do on the sporting page with those two if they were two front linemen on a football team. They call down fire from heaven on anyone that opposes them. Not pleasant to be with. Seeking first place in the kingdom. And cowards that they were, sending their mother to ask for it. Suddenly, no matter how you want to slice it, this son of thunder, John, like a lightning bolt, suddenly becomes the symbol of all disciples, John becomes a symbol of love and the tender of the mother of Christ. Cataclysmic change. Peter, whatever else you might say about this apostle whose name was changed to symbolize by the very name the rock, Peter is characterized with instability, cowardice, extremism. When Jesus is washing feet, he says, "Oh, I'm going to wash mine." Well, if I can't wash your feet, you're not going to be in my kingdom. Then wash me all over. All he wanted was his feet. Well, here, take it all. He talks of his death, and one's going to deny him. Not me. I won't deny you. Though they slay me, I won't deny you. Three times before the cock crows in the morning, he denies him. Even after the resurrection, Jesus sends a tender message to him, "Go tell my disciples and Peter to let him know he's still in Christ's heart. I'll meet you at Galilee." Jesus is late in Peter's view, and he's out there fishing. Won't wait. Peter, when Jesus talks of the cross, "Be it far from you to get the rebuke, get behind me, Satan." He's asked to sleep in the garden, goes to sleep, wakes up when the Roman soldiers come, grabs the sword, and it's a bleary eye, he swings the sword. I still can't figure out how he got that high priest's servant's ear and missed his head and his neck and other parts. Unstable. Changed into the absolute front runner of courage in those first proclamations of the resurrection. Unable to stand with Jesus the night of the crucifixion, denying that he even knew him. Now in front of a mocking mob on the streets of Jerusalem, addresses them and calls them murderers and proclaims the resurrection. And continues to do it when they're going to throw him in prison and say, "You've got to stop preaching it." He says, "Will I obey man or God?" And he says, "You desired a murderer. You hanged Christ on a tree, but God raised him up. Or you hang Jesus on a tree." Becomes the rock, the foundation on which the church is built. James, I don't think too much of him. But the only record of Jesus' family is they were against him. They sought to lay hands on him at Nazareth because they thought he was beside himself. And if any one of your relatives went around making the claim Jesus made about himself, you'd be embarrassed too. They wanted to pull him away from the crowd. There is no evidence that his family ever embraced Jesus apart from his mother standing by the cross until after the resurrection. Then James becomes the pastor of the church at Jerusalem itself. This Pharisee of the Pharisees, most likely a member of the Essenes himself, changed into a supporter and follower, though he dragged his old legalistic viewpoints in. He changed and recognized this so-called brother, member of his family, born of Mary. He had to stand back. Truly, this is a God. Cataclysmically changed. Thomas, look at the way it's woven into the story again. Thomas is consistent in his doubting. He always is a doubter, no matter what. He's a doubter. Jesus is facing a dangerous journey. I've done this with you before. Thomas says, "Let us also go that we may die with him." He had to be rebuked with the teaching of Jesus. The shepherd lays down his life for the flock. No man takes his life from him. But to Thomas, it was a dangerous journey. Jesus might be killed and let go and die with him. Naturalistic human view of the Master. Jesus is talking about his going away and that he will go and prepare mansions, come back and get them and take them to where he is. And then in the midst of his message, he says, whither I go, you know, and the way you know. Now, I've parodied this every year. I can see the rest of them, they're hung up. The minute he says, I'm going to prepare mansions, they probably didn't even hear where he was going. Oh, goody. I hope mine's going to be on the prime beach site. Mansions. But Thomas listened. Jesus said, I'm going to go away. You don't have to be super spiritual to understand that. He's leaving. I'm going to a place. Well, I don't know where, but okay. I'm going to prepare mansions. That's good. And then I'm going to come back. I understand that. And I'm going to get you and take you to be with me in that place where I prepared mansions. Okay, good news. And whither I go, you know, and the way you know. Whoa! He's listening. And he butts in and says, we don't know where you're going. How can we know the way? Now, it isn't. One of these other guys, when the report of the resurrection comes, that's saying, I don't believe it. Same guy. I don't know who orchestrated this, if it's a lie, to weave in separate recorders written in different places, manuscripts by people that are lying, if that's our assumption, and don't know it's going to become canonized and looked at sacred scripture. And they weave into these separate documents this profile of this doubter so that when it comes resurrection time, he's the one that says, I will not believe it until I put my hand into the prints. And Jesus says, behold my hands and my side. And says, it's more blessed to believe without seeing. That's common sense. You don't have to wrestle with your brain. But he didn't rebuke Thomas. He offered to submit to the very test. This cataclysmic change sends Thomas to the most philosophic, difficult to preach this truth area of the world. Across the Himalayas to be pierced with a Brahmin sword near Madras, India. The churches in India still revere his ministry in that area. Never to doubt again. Totally transformed. Now, whether you believe the resurrection or not, you can date cataclysmically to a spot every one of these personalities cataclysmically changing, and by any kind of ethical or philosophic criteria, a change for the better. From doubt to faith is better than living in agnosticism and never taking a position, even if your aim is wrong. From son of thunder to love, from instability to a rock, from a rejecting family member to a solid believer. Number three, they all suffered inhuman persecution for the lie. Thomas pierced with a sword, St. Andrew cross on the cross that gets his name, crucified in that crisscross cross, Luke dragged to death. Or rather, Mark dragged to death. Luke hanged on an olive tree. Peter crucified upside down. Bartholomew skinned to death with a whip. On the record goes, everyone save John. Died a horrible martyr's death. And four, St. Thomas Aquinas, great proof of the resurrection. They died alone. Now, I got the time just barely to do this. Wakeman, you be Peter over in Rome. Dan, you be Thomas over in India. And I'll be Bartholomew, being beaten to death, skinned alive with a whip. we've gone our separate ways to tell this lie. Now, I can believe you put us together as a group. No one of us wants to be the first to break down and betray this conspiracy. But separate us in an age with no communication like today. You most probably don't even know I'm in Armenia. You're in Rome. Chances of you know what happens to me is very remote. You're over in India. We've gone our separate way of telling the story, and we all face death. And all I got to do up in Armenia is say, didn't happen. Didn't happen. I'll swear to anything you want me to swear to. It just didn't happen. Sorry. And I escape with a slap on the hand, save my life. And when I see you, since I'm a liar anyway, boy, I want to tell you something. They tried to get me to break faith, Mike, but I wouldn't let us down. I never would yield. It's so ridiculous. It's psychologically inconceivable that each of these people die, pay the supreme price for telling this lie, and nowhere on the pages of history or in its dirt will you find one of them ever backing out of the story. It is psychologically maybe conceivable they would die as a group if they stayed together. Totally inconceivable there wouldn't be one weak link that would break down somewhere on this globe that would say, we made it up. And as Larry Thomas said, Gene, I'm convinced they believed what they were preaching and paid the supreme price for it. Therefore, one of your other eight facts must be wrong. I gotcha. Fine, then this is all we gotta settle, isn't it? And that's been settled so many times. He raised, and because he raised, that power that brought him from the grave shall so dwell in us and is the basis of the righteousness of God that is brought out of the grave and made available to us. And that's where I am next Sunday. That's my message. Offering time. Now, available in the bookstore is this six-volume series that takes you through the uniqueness of Christ and the evidence of the resurrection, Jesus Christ, Supernut or Supernatural. Also, as I announced, and I now have the evidence, I have a complete set, CD-ROM, video, and CD-audio. First 12 volumes of Romans now available. That's wonderful news. It's offering time. I'll be looking at you on television. Be faithful to your posts. Song again. Rise again. Good day, folks.